Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak about the Alito hearings and his likely appointment to the Supreme Court as to replace Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. We'll be speaking in a moment with Dawn Johnson, who is a professor of the Indiana Law University School of Law. She was formerly the staff counsel fellow of the ACLU and then was 5 years as legal director of NARAL. We'll be speaking also with Dean Lawrence Velville, who's practiced law at the Department of Justice and written numerous briefs for the Supreme Court. He is also one of the founders of the Massachusetts School of Law, where he currently serves as dean. We'll also speak with David K. Johnson, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for the New York Times. He's also recently won the Investigative Book of the Year Award for his new book, Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. And we'll be looking into a new move on the part of the IRS to no longer publish its record of who it audits and how much it practices tax fairness in terms of taxing the poor and letting the rich escape their share. So we'll be talking about that issue as well as looking into perhaps or trying to divine the motives of the new Iranian leader in terms of his confrontation with the Europeans, which will likely lead to a referral to the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and then on to the United Nations Security Council for sanctions. So we'll be talking about the latest crisis with Iran. I'm now speaking with Dawn Johnson and Dean Lawrence Velville. And let me begin with you, Dawn Johnson. It seems to me that the consensus after the hearings, this was a moment perhaps for the Democrats to, on the national stage, to present themselves perhaps in view of the upcoming elections in November of this year as some kind of an alternative. And the consensus seems to be general that they blew it. Do you feel they blew it?
Well, I do think that it's absolutely clear Judge Alito did extremely well and proved extremely skillful in avoiding answering questions and giving us any further indication into his views. He, of course, had a very extensive record going into the hearings, and so the senators had a great deal to work with. So whether you say the Democratic senators blew it or the nominee and Republican senators proved more skillful in
I wouldn't say that. They were more or less the cheer squad.
I think that the blame really belongs everywhere. So I don't want it to only blame the Democratic senators. I think some of them were quite dogged in their questioning, and I think many of them tried hard to their abilities. I do think that part of the blame has to be put squarely on, as I said, the nominee and the Republican senators for continually coming up with shifting justifications for not answering questions, not telling the American public what it has a right to know in these hearings.
Dean Lawrence Velville, do you think, it seemed to me that I wished that somebody could have asked a more basic simple questions, and rather than the sort of windy soliloquies from Joe Biden and others, dropping Latin terms, etc. I mean, just somebody that was could plain speakingly say something to the effect that, well, you believe in original intent, and does that mean that what you believe is that the Constitution is frozen as it was back in the days of the Founding Fathers, and that only white men of property should vote? I mean, why can't they phrase things in ways that the public could understand what's at stake here?
Well, I cannot answer the question of why they can't. I only know that being politicians and very, very windy people, they don't. If you ask me, and I actually had this in a blog a few days ago while the hearings were in the early days, so to speak, They should have asked the following kinds of questions. Can the president authorize kidnapping at home or abroad if he thinks this is desirable? Can the president order torture at home or abroad if he thinks this is desirable? Can he order warrantless electronic surveillance at home or abroad if he thinks it desirable? Can he order American citizens to be jailed indefinitely? Now, when you ask those kinds of questions, the fact that he will not answer them, which he would not have, shows to everybody very clearly that you have here a person who might rule that the president can do these things, and people would have understood far more readily that this is potentially, at least, we do not know, but this is potentially at least a very dangerous nominee. And I think it's rather terrible that after this windbaggery that went on in the hearings, the Democrats, if one is to believe the New York Times of the last 2 days, have more or less called it quits and given up on trying to stop Alito. My personal view, and I put this in a blog, is that because he will not answer questions to which we think we know what his answer would be, and we think that is why he did not answer them, because it would have put the kibosh on his nomination. What the Democrats ought to do, in my judgment, instead of being quitters, which that sounds from the New York Times like they are being, is they ought to say, we're going to filibuster this one, and just to show you that you cannot say we are against anybody and everybody whom George Bush would put up, a question that was asked to me on television the other day, just to show you that we are not that way, we will say right now that if he were, for example, to nominate Arlen Specter, we will, in a New York minute, confirm that nomination. I haven't always thought so well about Arlen Specter, particularly after his performance with Anita Hill, but I think this last round has shown that he has a very good sense of privacy and of the really crucial issue that faces this country, which is the extent of executive power and whether the executive can do things that the executive has never before been able to do and can do them in the face of congressional statutes saying you can't, like torture, like wiretapping, and so forth.
Don Johnson?
Yes.
What about the subtext that appeared to be all over these hearings, and that is, or all under these hearings, I guess, that is the culture wars of the 60s and questions about his membership in that fairly disgraceful organization of reactionaries at Princeton,
right. which he
dodged. It seems to me that, again, I wish there was some plain speaking. I mean, I understood the Vietnam War was an occasion where the United States government had screwed up monstrously, and the people eventually came out of their torpor and stopped that war. So it seems to me that even though there was some excesses from sex, drugs, and rock and roll and demonstrations, etc., the bottom line is that the people who were demonstrating ended up being right, didn't they?
Mm-hmm. I think this is implicit in what you're both saying. I think the issue of presidential power and the president's war powers must be at the top of everyone's list of what's at stake. And I think the hearings did focus quite a bit on presidential power. There were some questions asked about warrantless wiretaps of U.S. citizens, for example. But I just want to emphasize how important it is that the American public realize that Judge Alito's record clearly suggests he is going to be a very strong supporter of presidential power that is not limited by Congress or the courts. And so that is tremendously dangerous when we have a president, as we do today, who thinks he has the right to violate statutes that ban torture and that require warrants before the president wiretaps American citizens. You know, if we don't have a court that is going to enforce federal statutes and hold the president to such statutes, then we have no check on an imperial presidency. And I really don't think that is overstating what is at stake in this nomination. So I think that some members of Congress did try to ask those kinds of questions, but it's difficult when, you know, I was on TV recently with Ted Olson, former Solicitor General, who was saying it would be unethical for a nominee to answer those questions. And the Republican senators in this hearing and in John Roberts' hearing, too, keep repeating that there are ethical restrictions on what a nominee can say. Just, I think, a flatly wrong, outrageous statement to make when we've had nominees in the past who have been much more forthcoming. And there's no ethical limit on answering these kinds of questions. So I think that part of what the media and law professors like those on this phone call, you know, we need to be educating people about how outrageous the position of the Republican senators and their supporters in this and the John Roberts nomination, how outrageous their positions have been. And I think that really is true, too, of the discussion of Judge Alito's membership in Concerned Alumni of Princeton. I mean, there he was a member. He bragged about his membership in an organization that was hostile to the rights of women, minorities, gays, just an incredibly offensive organization. And his response is he didn't remember being a member, though he listed as one of only two organizations that he was a member of back when he applied for a political position in the Reagan administration. So I think the Democratic senators did not push as hard as I would have liked them to, but when you have the Republican senators, some of them at least, willing to say it would be unethical for him to answer the question, it really, I think, is incumbent on all of us to say just how outrageous and wrong that is, and not let them get away with being so hypocritical. And it is is entirely inconsistent with the position the Republicans took in the Reagan administration. In the Reagan administration, the Reagan Meese Justice Department advocated considering the legal views of Supreme Court nominees. And they said, they wrote actually, that few factors are more critical to determining the course of the nation than the values and philosophies of the men and women who populate the federal judiciary. That was their position 20 years ago. Now it's not politically convenient, and they've completely backed down from that, and they'll make up excuses, shifting justifications for saying nominees may not answer questions.
Well, I should say, if you go on the witness stand and you say, I can't answer because it's unethical for me to answer, I don't think the judge would be too happy. Dean Velville, why is it that the judicial and the legislative branches of government are rolling over for two presidential lawyers in a row who are coming? One's now the Chief Justice, and the other one's going to be replacing Sandra Day O'Connor. I mean, don't they see the writing on the wall?
Oh, I'm sure they do. But I have to say that there are a number of answers to your questions. One is lack of political courage. One is they don't really care as much as they should about what could very conceivably happen in the future. And the third is that they've been horns woggled by what Professor Johnson has been talking about. This business that allegedly a judge cannot answer questions about topics that may come up is a latter-day invention stemming from hearings involving Scalia, Ruth Ginsburg, and John Roberts. Most fundamentally, it has been used to enable highly right-wing nominees not to answer questions, because it is known that if they were to answer the questions, they would probably not be confirmed. I'm sure the president and his people have a pretty good idea of what the answers to the questions would be. That's why they've nominated these people. I know that in Massachusetts, I am told, they do exactly ask of nominees the kinds of questions that I have said that I said before should have been asked. You have to also remember a very important point, and one of two very important points, one of which is never discussed. One of those important points is that even if a nominee were to tell you his current thinking on some of these subjects, such as presidential power, overruling Roe versus Wade, and so forth, he is not bound to that opinion when a case comes before him or her. All he has done is told you in advance what his current thinking is. And you should all, people should also understand, and nobody ever talked, I've never heard this discussed, when a judge writes an opinion, he is bound by what he says by stare decisis. So the argument here that a judge would be, if he were to talk to the Congress about his views, he would be pre-committing himself. That committing oneself is exactly what one does when one writes an opinion after being a judge, except that at that point, you are bound by what you have said, whereas if you merely tell Congress what your current thinking is, you are not bound and you are free, as Alito has talked about and as Roberts talked about, to change your mind later if in the context of an actual case people come up with good arguments and facts that cause you to change your mind. So this business is, if you ask me, humbug from beginning to end, but the press has never considered why it's humbug. The Democrats never considered why it's humbug. And everybody has been willing to immediately accept the shibboleth, which is false, that a judge cannot comment on questions which might come up before him. And as Professor Johnson has said, you know, it's almost farcical. They comment on subjects that might come up before them when they think that to do so will be beneficial to them or at minimum will not hurt them. It is only when you get into things like presidential power and abortion where their answer will hurt them that suddenly they refuse to comment.
Oh, I could not agree more. That is absolutely right. And I just want to add one point to that. When you have now a period where there's not an actual nominee before the Senate Judiciary Committee, you've just gone through two rounds of hearings. I think this is the perfect time for the senators to take a hard look at the process and address these questions head on. So we have Senator Spector, you know, Republican committee chair, opening the last two hearings saying this has become a game. You know, he's admitting the whole thing's a farce. He
says, and so did Biden, by the way.
And so did Senator Biden. So we have, you know, bipartisan agreement here that these hearings are close to useless. Senator Spector said nominees say as little as they can get away with and still get confirmed. You know, that's not good for anyone. So I think there's a tendency once the hearing is over for the, you know, the media to move on, say, you know, that's done. But I think that the senators and the media and concerned people need to say, you know, let's fix it now when we have an opportunity to consider reform when we do not have an individual sitting before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and that, I think, should be taken up immediately, or we should just put an end, maybe, to these hearings and say, let's admit we're not learning anything from them.
And Dean Velvel, it seems that the Democrats are a little bit shaken by this experience, and they're having a caucus, I believe, on Wednesday, and there's some indications that they may basically just vote on a party line. Does that bother you at all in terms of judicial nominees where, you know, essentially if it becomes an exercise of a party line vote, then that, I think, is an admission of bankruptcy, isn't it?
Well, it would not bother me in the current context because the Republicans will support George Bush down to the last American life in Iraq, or for whatever other problem happens to come up. That's a bit of an overstatement, but it's certainly not an overstatement in the context of this hearing. The Democrats, I would hope, would oppose this judge. There have been other judges where views have been split, as when Arlen Specter himself voted against Judge Robert Bork. Many times the votes are split. What bothers me about the upcoming caucus this week is the sense that, as I said before, the Democrats, if you believe the New York Times, at least their news pages, because their editorials have been very good, according to the Times, the Democrats have thrown in the towel, when instead of throwing in the towel, they ought to say, hey, we are going to filibuster this guy, and just to show you that we are not unalterably opposed to any Republican, we will, if the president sends up somebody like Specter, we will confirm that person immediately. I think it's very important that the Democrats don't throw in the towel. And from what I gather, there is a lot of feeling out in the country, Republicans and Democrats alike, Republicans strangely enough perhaps, that is very worried about this man, especially because of his views of presidential powers. I was on a program the other night, and it was a one-hour program, and they had this silly television straw poll, you know. And halfway through the straw poll, the question was, is Alito too conservative to be confirmed? 52% of the people said, no, he is not, halfway through the program. At the end of the program, 70% of the people had said, yes, he is. And I gather that the calls to the senator's offices are running, at least I've heard on television, 60-40 against Alito. I think there's a widespread concern about this man in the country, and the Democrats will be doing no good for the country, let alone for themselves, if they just roll over and die on this one.
But Don Johnson, it seems to me that the moment that probably saved Alito from any real scrutiny was a television moment where his wife was in tears, and it seems to me that much as what's happening in terms on the political left, they're essentially wasting Norman Lear's money, lobbying trying to light a fire under the Democratic senators. Is there a way, and you kind of implied there might be, to reach out directly to the people?
I'll tell you, I didn't see that episode. I heard about it. My wife thinks that Mrs. Alito shouldn't have done what she did. I sympathize with Mrs. Alito. I rather imagine that her husband is not a bigot, to tell you the truth. And she and he both had to sit there for 4 days and listen to things, some of which were fairly outrageous and not very competent.
Though I do have to say, she started crying in response to Senator Lindsey Graham's characterization of some of the comments, are you a bigot? That came from a Republican senator. No Democrat came close to saying anything that offensive. They were asking, why were you a member of this bigoted organization?
Maybe you've never had people take out after you, but if somebody who has had lots of people take out after me, I can tell you that it's very touching when somebody comes to your rescue. And so I sympathize with Mrs. Alito about this. And I think that Democrats ought to come right out and say, look, this man is not a bigot, mm-hmm. as far as we know. You asked about the culture of the 60s. And, you know, this man comes from the intellectual hard hat conservative ethnic community that was turned from Democrats into Republicans by Richard Nixon and made a permanent part of the Republican Party by Ronald Reagan. That's his background. And one has to expect that, you know, he would have the views that stem from that background. That's perfectly legitimate in this country. It's what we expect in this country, that one has a right to one's own views stemming from one's background. But the Democrats ought to say, look, this is not a matter of whether Sam Alito is a good or a bad human being or whether he is or is not a bigot. I personally don't think he's a bigot. Mm-hmm. I do find it difficult to believe that he didn't know anything about CAP, that he didn't remember anything about Vanguard, but I don't think he's a bigot. But I think the Democrats should say this is not about whether Sam Alito is a nice guy, not a nice guy, what background he comes from. This is about how is he likely or at least possibly going to rule when all these questions of presidential power, including torture, including wiretapping, including presidential statements, when he signs a bill attempting to gut what Congress has done, that's what we're concerned about, and that's why we're filibustering this.
Just in closing, yes, Dawn.
Senators have said that. Some of the Democratic senators have absolutely said exactly that, which I agree is the right thing to say. I do think that message is not getting out there as much as the image of Mrs. Alito crying on TV. And I also sympathize with her. I think, you know, the whole experience is extremely emotional, sitting there for hours and hours. I was merely saying that I do not believe that the Democratic senators were unfairly harsh. I do believe they've said, we don't think you're personally a bigot. We just want to know why you were a member of this offensive organization and how you were going to rule on all of these issues that are essential to protecting the rights and liberties of Americans. Executive power, I think we've covered thoroughly on this call, and that's one of the top issues. Another I just need to make sure the listeners realize is there's no question Judge Alito on the Supreme Court would vote to dramatically curtail the right of women to choose to have an abortion. Whether or not he'd expressly overrule Roe, I think, was addressed in the hearings, but that's only one set of questions. It's important also that there's more than one way to overrule Roe, and there's no question in my mind he will uphold restrictions on abortion that will amount to an effective overruling of Roe for many, many women.
Well, of course, his memo that was cited back in the 80s was he outlined the strategy to chip away at the foundation, which is exactly what's been happening over the last few decades.
That is exactly right. He could not have been more clear in that memo, and he bragged about his memo and his incremental strategy to overrule Roe when he later applied for a political appointment, a higher-up appointment in the Reagan administration. And so his position could not be clearer. You know, it's difficult to imagine a nominee with a more express record of opposition to Roe and the right to choose abortion. Mm. And he expressly said he would not distance himself from that the hearings.
Well, I'm afraid we'll be entering an era where young women will be catching Greyhound buses from the red states to the blue states, and perhaps it'll be too late, but that's when people will wake up about what's really at stake here. And I thank both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was speaking then with Dawn Johnson, who is on the faculty at the Indiana School of Law, and she's former staff counsel for the ACLU and was a legal director for NARAL, and also Dean Lawrence Velville, who's practiced law at the Department of Justice and written numerous briefs for the Supreme Court, and he's one of the founders of the Massachusetts School of Law. I'm now speaking with David K. Johnson, who won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for his reporting for the New York Times on tax inequity. And in 2003, he was a double finalist for the Pulitzer for the New York Times, also reporting on tax issues. And he was the winner in 2003 of the Investigative Book of the Year Award, which is awarded by the Investigative Reporters and Editors for his new book, Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. And David K. Johnson, what's happening now, though, in terms of a shift from apparently since 1976 the IRS was made available to scholars? They're essentially an audit of who they audit, a record of who they audit, which is a way to for the public to get a sense of tax fairness and how even-handed they are. And now they've suddenly stopped apparently doing that after decades of doing it. What's the motive here? Is it that they are just too embarrassed about what's happening?
Well, Ian, I don't know what the motive is, but there's no question what they've done. The IRS publishes an enormous amount of data, but there are certain key facts that they have only provided pursuant to this 1976 order by a federal judge. Such things as gross data, not individual cases, but statistical data on when an audit determines that a corporation or an individual owes more tax, how much do they really pay? That's part of what was covered by this court order. So is the number of hours that are spent overall on audits of big corporations and rich people, which would allow you to get an idea of how thoroughly are they auditing them or how superficially. And the IRS in May of 2004 simply announced that it would no longer give this data to Syracuse University, where they have a program that collects raw data from lots of government agencies, the FBI and the Homeland Security Department and elsewhere, and they translate it into plain or reasonably plain English and put it up on the web so that citizens like you and I can go and examine it at track.syr.edu. And when there were complaints about this by the woman who'd obtained the court order, Professor Susan Long at Syracuse, she got a letter back from one of the most senior executives in the IRS saying, well, I assigned a bunch of lawyers to look into this, and there is no court order and standing order, and we're not therefore obligated to give this to you. It was astonishing. She immediately mailed them a copy of the court order. And when I interviewed Frank Keith, who is the chief spokesman at the very top of the IRS about this, the guy who's been assigned to handle this, he said, well, you know, that was 30 years ago, and nobody around here remembered. We thought voluntarily we'd been giving this, so we had no obligation. Well, now that they've seen the court order, their position is, we're still not going to give it to you anymore because it's too expensive, and we can't afford it anymore. And that, Ian, is part of a broader fundamental trend that has been taking place under this particular administration. I can't show you where it emanates from, but Professor Long, in her experience dealing with other agencies, mine as a reporter, that if many other people have written about it, have seen a tightening up on the flow of information from government agencies.
But without being able, you know, obviously it's difficult to find divine motive, but it would seem that the record that's being hidden that was previously available is a continuing drift towards squeezing the poor and letting the rich slide.
Well, absolutely. This movement in the country is very clear, and there is a program, which we learned this last week from the taxpayer advocate. You know, the Congress in U.S. Senate in 1997-98 held hearings on the IRS, and they had these people get up and say, oh, you know, terrible things have happened to me. And it turned out later that most of these witnesses were themselves tax criminals, suspected or proven, and that their stories, when examined, did not hold up. Nonetheless, Congress passed a law to protect taxpayers from the overzealous IRS, from the tax police, because they were concerned about the degree of law enforcement. But they also created the Office of Taxpayer Advocate and empowered the advocate who works in the IRS to basically be an in-house inspector of what was going on and required a report to Congress. And this last week, Nina Olson, the inspector, reported that the IRS has labeled at least, or she estimates, 1.6 million returns filed mostly by poor people as fraudulent. In fact, labeled some of them so clearly fraudulent they were conclusively fraudulent. Now remember, this is the cops, the tax police, the IRS, making this determination. No judge, no jury, they're making that determination, telling people you don't get your refund. We're freezing your refund, and I mean not telling them, just doing it without telling them that, and then flagging their tax returns for unknown number of years to come to make sure that they were continually closely examined. Well, the taxpayer advocate went and examined a sample of these returns, and it turned out that two-thirds of the people were entitled to every penny they asked for or more. Another 14% were entitled to part of the money. And of the remaining 20%, they think it's simply things like math errors and other mistakes, not fraud.
Well, let me just give you a couple of statistics here that I think indicate this inexorable move that's underway. And the United States has the dubious distinction of having the greatest exacerbation between the rich and the poor. But it's a global phenomenon. The overall share of federal taxes paid by U.S. corporations is now less than 10%, down from 21% in 2001, and over 50% during World War II. One-third of America's largest and most profitable corporations pay zero taxes or actually receive credits in at least one of the last 3 years. That's from Forbes magazine. Back in 1980, the average American chief executive earned 40 times as much as the average manufacturing employee. At the top tier of America's CEOs, the ratio is now 475-1, and it would be vastly greater if assets in addition to income were taken into account. By way of comparison, the ratio in Britain is 24-1, in France 15-1, in Sweden 13-1. Isn't that pretty shameful?
Well, I don't know if shameful is the right word. It is a very important trend that I've written a lot about, Ian, and let me give you one other really important indicator. If you look at income inequality using standard measures around the world, of the 31 biggest economies, the only two countries more unequal than the United States, and basically the only ones in the same ballpark that we're in, are Mexico and Russia. Now, that is an interesting neighborhood for the United States to be in. And there's no question that government policies are driving this. It is government policies that allow what even people in the field all acknowledge is a rigged market to inflate the pay of chief executive officers at publicly traded companies. It is government policy that makes it possible to pay that kind of money. Back in 1972, when I was a reporter at the San Jose Mercury News, I remember reading that the chief executive of Pacific Gas and Electric, the biggest utility in the country, does almost all of Northern California, made 10 times what I made. Well, today he makes 500 times what I make, if not more than that. There's been this tremendous shift, and those pay raises at the top are not free. The American economy would have to be 8 times bigger than it is to justify the pay of these CEOs based on productivity. So what's happening is, if you're a rank-and-file worker, even if you're a low-level manager or a low-level executive, you're making less money and particularly getting less in fringe benefits. The quality of your health care plan and your retirement plan, if you even have one, so that we can feed the guys at the very top. The competition is not between Company A and Company B. It's between the guys in the corner suites and the ordinary workers. And I, in Perfectly Legal, I lay out just how this works and how government policy actually encourages this.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with David K. Johnson, who is a 2001 Pulitzer Prize winner, and he's also in 2003 won the Investigative Book of the Year Award for his new book, Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. He covers tax and tax fairness issues for the New York Times, and we're talking about the disparity in tax on income, particularly where fewer and fewer of the wealthiest people are being audited and more of the poorer people are being audited. And now, just you obviously know both the top people at the IRS and the rank and file. It would seem to me that the rank and file people at the IRS probably don't have any sympathy for this disparity. But isn't the bottom line problem here that the rich, and particularly these CEOs we're talking about, who earn 475 times more than their average guy on the shop floor, they have vast tax accounting companies to back them up with hundreds of accountants, and that's why they don't pay taxes. So how can the IRS get around the fact that, I mean, obviously the poor are vulnerable because they can't afford H&R Block, but the rich have an army of smart guys dedicated to avoiding paying tax.
Well, Ian, it's an important thing to understand. Two things. The CEOs, the 475 figure you mentioned, that doesn't count their retirement benefits, which would increase their pay by roughly a third. So we're talking about probably more than 600 times average pay. People who have very big incomes, like CEOs, generally pay very big taxes. Some of them cheat, and not all of those who cheat get caught. But overall, those people with very high incomes do pay very big taxes. But those who are cheating, and that's why I'm surprised more honest rich people aren't unhappy about this, are getting a free ride. And the reason they're not getting caught is that Congress has radically cut, in real terms, compared to the size of the economy, the capacity of the IRS to enforce the law. That is, we have this bizarre situation where we have currently Republican leaders who've all run against the IRS. And what are they really doing when they do that? They are running against law enforcement because the IRS are the tax police. What a bizarre notion that the party of law and order has people who are running against law enforcement. The rank-and-file people at the IRS, they get assigned what to do. They don't go pick things. Computers say, go do this, return, and that. And Congress has given, since 1997, Congress has given the IRS more than $1 billion extra dollars for only one important area, and that is to pursue tax cheating by the working poor. Not to go after very rich people, not to go after big corporations. That's been radically reduced. In fact, the President of the United States stopped the IRS from spending $12 million more to go after Osama bin Laden's money, saying the taxpayers couldn't afford it. So we have a situation in which it is the policy of the government that we have lots of money, $1 billion since 1997, to increase policing of tax returns by the poor, but we can't afford $12 million a year to go after Osama bin Laden's money. Isn't that bizarre?
Well, we could probably call that the Jack Abramoff loophole. But because that's ultimately, you can see what's going on in Washington, that how much they are both lobbying for the rich. And in fact, you could argue that our representatives represent capital and not people.
Well, it certainly is a big change. You know, back in 1920, we froze the size of Congress. There were fewer than 100 million Americans there. This year, we're going to hit 300 million Americans. So congressional districts are, on average, three times the size they would be if we hadn't frozen the size of Congress. That is, we could have three times as many members of Congress. And if we did, I wonder if it would be much more the people's house instead of the lobbyist's house.
Well, let's just in the closing minutes, David K. Johnson, deal with the other issue that I brought up, which is the fact that corporations are paying less and less federal taxes, now down from 21% in 2001 to, it's down to 10%. In 2001, they were paying 21% of the revenues brought in, and 50% during World War II. And one-third of America's largest and most profitable corporations pay zero taxes.
They pay zero taxes in any given year. This is a phenomenon that's very important. It is going on all over the world. Essentially, you know, as we have a globalized economy, which in the long run is going to make all of us better off,
You believe that?
Oh, sure. I think the classic economic theory makes it clear that in the long run, specialization is more efficient and more effective. But you and I aren't going to live in the long run. You know, as John Maynard Keynes said, in the long run, we are all dead. Okay. The rules, however, for this transition to a global economy are being written entirely from the perspective of finance and capital. And what's happening is that capital is going to those places where it doesn't have to pay taxes. Back in 1980, 1% of U.S. corporate profits were taken in tax havens like the Cayman Islands, where little or no tax is paid. By the year 2002, it was up to 17%. The data is not available yet for future calculations, but I assure you that 10 or 15 years from now, probably half of U.S. corporate profits will be taken, big corporate profits, in tax havens. And by the way, if you're a purely domestic company, you know, these family businesses, congressmen are always talking about that they're supporting family businesses, they're getting treated as badly in this as the wage earners are. These tax laws that are allowing this all benefit multinational corporations. And the same structures that allow multinational corporations to take taxes in tax havens and hide money there are the same structures that allow terrorists to move their money around undetected.
Well, I understand that. I remember interviewing the head of the State Department's Bureau of
Foreign Asset Control.
Well, it used to be called Drugs and Thugs.
Yes.
You might know him, Jonathan Weiner.
Yes.
But he pointed that out some time ago. I think we've run out of
the rules. The rules are being made. They are not. One of the things the polls are showing, I think, is quite clear, is that there is a perception now by large numbers of Americans that the activities of our Congress represent not the interests of the people who elected them, but the interests of the K Street crowd in Washington and lobbyists and big corporations who finance the campaigns and whom I would argue are the real, and I have argued in Perfectly Legal, are the real bosses to whom members of Congress have to respond if they want to get reelected.
The best Congress that money can buy.
That's right. And why buy Congress when you can rent it so cheaply?
I thank you so much for joining us, David K. Johnson.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking then with David K. Johnson, who won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for his reporting in the New York Times on tax fairness, and the 2003 Investigative Book of the Year Award for his new book, Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everyone Else. I'm now speaking with Dr. Mezier Behrouz, who is professor of Middle East History at the California State University in San Francisco. His most recent book is Rebel with a Cause, The Failure of the Left in Iran. What do you think, Dr. Behrouz, is the motive for the new Iranian president in choosing to confront the Europeans are normally the sort of moderates in this argument. It was always the U.S. versus Iran. Now it looks like the Europeans are joining with the United States, and it'll probably get referred. And in fact, the Dr. El-Baradei of the IAEA, he came out very clearly exhibiting anger and frustration with the Iranian leadership. over their determination. So why is Akhmanijad trying to pick a fight?
Hi. I think, you know, we need to separate two things here. On one hand, what the president, the new president Ahmadinejad, is saying. And on the other hand, the whole collective decision-making process in Iran regarding the nuclear issue, the nuclear energy issue. It seems to me that the whole leadership has come to conclude that it is that the freeze on activity is not getting anywhere, and that Iran needs to have control over full production of nuclear energy, and that the demand that the cycle, at least the enrichment cycle, to be moved outside Iran is an infringement upon Iran's national sovereignty, etc., etc. So it is not only the new president who is voicing this policy, but the whole collective leadership. On the other hand, we need to look at Ahmadinejad himself and what he is trying to do. I think we must understand that the Iranian president does not really have that much power in the order of things in Iran. The previous reformist president didn't have it, and this populist conservative president doesn't have it either. In this context, I think he is trying to basically find a place for himself and try to influence political decision-making internally in Iran. So his populist appeal, his attacks on Israel, and his voiceful proclamations regarding the nuclear issue, I think are basically can be understood within the domestic policy processes in Iran, rather than anything particularly new. So what we have here is basically Iranian leadership with considerable, I think, popular backing, coming to the conclusion that this process of negotiating with the Europeans over the issue of Iran's nuclear energy program, which they claim, of course, to be peaceful and non-military, is not getting anywhere, and that what they need to do is to push forward with it by opening up the seals and conducting research. This is what they are claiming.
Well, obviously, it's a popular winning issue in terms of nationalism, and arguably that's one of the motives for Ahmadinejad. But the long and the short of it is that when, which is likely, the United Nations invokes sanctions against Iran, that'll be a kind of a cold shower, will it not?
It would, and if I were them, and I wrote an article this last summer in Iran, and I told my suggestion was to make a compromise, and basically try to move around the issue. But if the conclusion in Tehran is that the nuclear issue is just a pretext, and that once the nuclear issue is resolved, other issues will come up, then the basic conclusion for them is to let's have the confrontation here. Perception is that it would have worked if a compromise over the nuclear issue was accompanied by concrete steps on the other side, the EU3 and the US, to benefit Iran and assure it that, for example, a military attack is not forthcoming, economic benefits will be there, WTO will be open to Iran, and things like that.
But it seems that Dr. Mezia Behrouz, that there already is underway a shift where the Iranians are moving away from not so much dependence, but the extent to which the United States can punish them. I mean, it seems to be a polity in Iran that's in many ways obsessed with America, going back to and always reminding the world, quite justifiably, that in 1953 the United States overthrew, or the CIA overthrew, a legitimate government, and it seems that wound is perpetual. But the long and the short of it, it seems that the Iranian government is making deals with oil deals with China, with the stands. It's a possibility of a pipeline going through to China eventually. And also with Russia, and the Russians have just supplied them apparently with extremely advanced ground-to-air missile interceptors. It seems to me, and there's also a rumor out there that Iran is perhaps going to try and denominate their oil in euros, which is apparently what Saddam threatened to do before he was invaded. So could you address the fact that Iran is positioning itself to get away from, being vulnerable to the United States?
Well, obviously, a country like Iran with oil reserve, energy reserves, and in a volatile region, is trying to diversify. And through diversification, trying to basically hook its economy to economies of more powerful states for both benefit and protection. So energy deals with China, pipeline through Pakistan to India, and interaction with Russia, I think, can be understood in that context. But Iran and many other countries, they just cannot deny the importance of the United States with its vast economy, military power, and diplomatic position internationally. So Iran needs to, at some point, come to terms with the reality of the United States being an important player in the international scene. Now, on the one hand, Iran jealously protects its national sovereignty and its independence. That's what the revolution was partly all about, the 1979 revolution. On the other hand, Iran needs to work with the U.S. In areas like Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in other places. So it's not a kind of a black and white picture. The two sides need to come together, but there are elements in both Iran and the U.S. which are pushing for confrontation, I think. We have it here in the shape and form of the neoconservative elements within the government. We have it in Iran with the more hawkish, belligerent elements within the Iranian government. And obviously, these two elements within both governments are not helping the situation.
Well, let's look at what happened recently. You indicated that even the new hardline government basically doesn't have any real power. That the what's it called, the Guardians Council, the hot Khamenei, who's the real head, and they overrule. Yes, they overrule them all the time. They even pick their candidates. I mean, it seems like a completely dysfunctional way to do business. And the last president, Khatami, even though he got a vast plurality from the people who in the country, is an extremely young country demographically. And apparently, I mean, this is anecdotal, and you spend more time, you visit often, but I get the impression that the young Iranians, who make up the 60-70% of the people, basically want to be more involved with the West, and particularly with Western music and consumerism, and they chafe under the oppression of this theocracy. But the long and the short of it is that whatever, however much Khatami dropped the ball, we didn't help, because our invasion next door in Iraq appears to have, before we went into Iraq, it seemed like there was a groundswell opposing the mullahs, and now it's as though the United States' blunder next door has driven them into the hands of the mullahs, and with saber-rattling coming from people like Vice President Cheney talking about a possible preemptive strike on Iran, I can't imagine that the Iranian opposition wants to be liberated by the United States, given what's happened next door in Iraq.
Iran-U.S. relations is full of missed moments. Certainly, since the events of September 11, 2001, things have not gotten better. And with the U.S. involvement in Iraq and the growing problems, I think, in Afghanistan, the prospects for U.S. involvement in the region for the long duration is clear. What they need to do, or what they should do, is to tone down. And when I was talking about the nuclear issue, I'm talking about it within this context. Toning down Iran's position is basically that within the context of international law, it has the right to have full research, development, and production of nuclear energy. The U.S. position, they're pushing the Europeans in that direction too, is that while it is legal, Iran has ulterior motives. They want to be able to master the technology and know-how and then jump into becoming nuclear. There must be a compromise here between the two, and this cannot be made without negotiations between the two sides. But one thing that worries me about the Iranian leadership, particularly Ahmadinejad's recent speech and media interview, is that he said that ultimately the West stands to lose more than Iran. And I think it's actually the other way around. Iran stands to lose more than the West in this confrontation. But the attitude that Iran stands to lose less and the West stands to lose more, this is itself a kind of a troubling statement to be made by a clearly weaker party in this type of confrontation.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I'm sorry we ran out of time, but I thank you for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Mazia Behrouz. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. So I was just speaking there with Dr. Mazia Behrouz, who's a professor of Middle East history at the California State University in San Francisco, and his most recent book is Rebels with a Cause, The Failure of the Left in Iran. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Jazz Shepard, the engineer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, and Carol Kuth, the assistant producer. This program and all previous ones are available at ianmasters.org. Bye.